From Southern California, this is The Circle of Insight, a show about everything in psychology. Hear the latest in news and views on psychology. Our motto is simple. Wherever there is psychology involved, we are there. And now, here's your host of The Circle of Insight, Carlos Vasquez.
From wherever you are around the world, welcome and thank you for joining us. Today we're going to be exploring the moral molecule. That's right, is morality innate? We're going to find out with Dr. Paul Zak. He is a professor of economics, psychology, and management at the Claremont Graduate University. Let's welcome him to the circle. Welcome to the circle, Dr. Zak.
Thank you so much.
This is a great topic. Not only does it make you feel good, it's oxytocin. We're going to find out more about that, but it's a great topic because it's such a unique study. I've never seen a study on the moral molecule. And that's a big issue out there right now in society is morality. And we're not going to get into Aristotle or Plato or any of those guys. But let's start off first with, what is oxytocin?
So I do think of morality as the longest debate humans have been having since we've been having debates, right? Are we good or evil? And I think that's a deep question. So we began thinking about this question in two ways. One is, could we get a really good neurologic target, right? Instead of just saying, some distributed network of brain regions. I don't know what that means. I'm a very practical guy. So we're really looking for a particular neurotransmitter that would focus as a signaling molecule that would tell us about this is the time to treat someone nicely, this is the time not to treat someone nicely. Number one. And number two, we didn't want to rely on self-report. So you're saying, I know you're a dear human being and you feed the homeless. And you know, what are you going to say in an experiment? Even if it's anonymous, right? You're going to make yourself sound good. So we did something, you know, slightly evil. We tempted people with virtue and vice by putting money on the table. So we said, look, you're anonymous. You can do whatever you want to do. Here's an interaction with another human, actually by computer in the laboratory. And so we're going to use this signaling molecule that we hypothesized, oxytocin, as our underlying concrete measure of whether you're motivated to do something kind for somebody else, even though you don't have to. So oxytocin is classically known in human beings as a hormone. It contracts the uterus during birth, facilitates milk flow for breastfeeding. But there was a rich animal literature developing that said that oxytocin identifies essentially familiar others of my species. So we're rodents, we're in the burrow, and I go, they do it by smell. Oh, that's Carlos, how wonderful. And so my brain makes oxytocin, and that motivates me to approach you, to engage with you, and if we can huddle up and stay warm and stay safe. So human beings had not been tested for the brain effects of oxytocin, and that's what we began doing. What's going on with oxytocin in the brain, not just in the reproductive realm, but both in men and women outside of reproduction?
That's fantastic. Let me ask you a quick question. I'm going to go take you back a little bit to the self-reporting. There was a study done a while back ago, I can't remember when, but they were asking people who thought was going to go to heaven. And it was, you know, what's the percentage of you going to heaven, percentage of Oprah going to heaven, and percentage of Mother Teresa? Cool. And the self-report, they actually reported themselves at a higher percentage than Mother Teresa. I think 85% of the people reported themselves going to heaven. Mother Teresa was unfortunately at 76%, believe it or not. Is that something why you decided not to do the self-reporting? Because we tend to look at ourselves a lot better than we are?
I think you put your finger on it earlier. It's exactly that. Because even if I'm anonymous, I have an incentive to make myself sound better, even to myself. There's a kind of a deeper neurologic reason. So let's suppose you like chocolate ice cream more than vanilla. And I ask you, gosh, why did you buy chocolate? You say, well, you know, I like it. It's brown. I don't know. You'll make up a bunch of the reasons. You don't really know. So the way the brain works, you know, the things that are most compelling to us, our desires, our behaviors when no one's watching, we don't really have insight into that, right? If I put you into a study or in a focus group and I force you to articulate why you think you're doing what you're doing, again, that data is really dirty. Again, because you don't really know and you're making stuff up and I'm forcing you to do it. So we said, let's just focus on behavior. And the follow-up question, of course, is, well, how do you know if behavior is moral or immoral? But actually, there's great consistency across cultures on what moral behavior is. And so there's great agreement, right? So murdering people, absent, you know, risk of your life, everyone agrees is bad, right? Bad. Sharing stuff you have, good. That's good moral behavior. Being generous, being trustworthy, being honest, right? So we can actually measure those things in a lab by looking at behaviors and not have to rely on self-report.
Good point.
And, you know, whether you're going to heaven or not, I don't know. And
I hope
but,
I am.
But we're concerned with, in some sense, a very narrow take on morality, which is your actions. I'm less interested in your intentions, although we can talk about intentions too, but I'm really about worried about the actions.
We're at. And remember, this is a special show. This will be a first 15-minute clip, and then we're going to extend it to extra footage if you want to see more about it. Who knows how long this interview is going to go, so stay tight, or hang tight. By the way, Dr. Paul Zak's book, here it is, The Moral Molecule. Definitely a must-read. Excellent book. Lots of fun. Let's continue on the conversation with oxytocin. So you described a little bit about what it does. You said it comes out, and the uterus is produced. I think it's produced in the uterus.
Produced only in the brain.
In the brain.
So it's released under stress or under physiologic stimulus, both in the brain and the body. And so unlike most other neurochemicals made in the brain, we'd actually measure its response by taking blood draw. So one of my former deans called this vampire economics. So we use money, so we want to use that to look at your moral or immoral behavior. And we were taking a lot of blood from people. So sort of the gold standard of looking at oxytocin is by measuring in blood, but also we manipulate it. So in the book, we talk about how we developed this protocol to safely get synthetic oxytocin into the human brain, which basically hadn't been done before because it was looked at as a reproductive hormone. So I tested it on myself. Who can I do this on? I had to do it on myself. And we worked out the right dosages, did our first study in Europe where their sort of regulations are a little looser, and now have FDA approval to do these studies in the U.S. And so what's interesting is that this work that began by asking this kind of basic good and evil question did spawn a lot of clinical research on things like autism, schizophrenia, social anxiety disorder. We've done work with psychopathology, so we can talk about all that. So I think once you have a new understanding of the kind of underlying brain mechanisms that produce appropriate social behaviors, then you have clinical targets, you have a way to assess people's dysfunctions, and new insights on how to treat them.
That's great. So what does oxytocin do then?
So it basically signals a familiarity, or it increases a sense of empathy. So when oxytocin is released, I'm more able to reflect or feel the emotions that you're having. And that's the reason why I call oxytocin the moral molecule. So once I share emotions with you, or enhance that shared emotion, I'm less likely to treat you badly because now I'm feeling pain if I give you that pain. But also, it's to the upside. I'm more likely to treat you well because now I get to share in your joy when I'm empathically connected to you. So functionally, oxytocin activates a larger brain circuit, which I call the home circuit. Home stands for human oxytocin-mediated empathy circuit. And it activates a circuit in the brain that essentially reinforces positive social behaviors. And it does this also through actions in the peripheral nervous system. It's relaxing. We've shown it improves the immune system. So when we connect to people, we begin to care about them. And I think what's interesting about our experiments is that it doesn't take much for you to care about a complete stranger, again, in a tangible way, not just on self-report, but, hey, you know, I'm sharing money with this person because, gosh, they just seem like they need it. How awesome is that?
That's a great, how do I get some of this hormone?
Yeah.
So how do we get it? Because I know you administered oxytocin, I think, through a nasal spray?
That's right. So the first thing we did was ask, in the kind of situations in which we can run the laboratory, the sort of share the money tasks, if someone shared money with you, they didn't have to, would your brain make oxytocin? And the answer was yes. And in fact, the more money someone shared with you intentionally, the more your brain made oxytocin. And then when given a chance to share money back with them, the more oxytocin you had on board, the more you shared back. So in this personal but depersonalized kind of setting, there was this underlying molecule that essentially motivated reciprocal behaviors. You're nice to me, I'll be nice to you. So that's essentially the golden rule, right? So the golden rule exists in every culture on the planet. The question is why? Well, humans have figured out that if you're a social creature, the way I sustain myself in the social group is you're nice to me, I'm nice to you. Most of the time is where the rubber hits the road, and we can talk about that in a second. And then to confirm that it really was oxytocin, as you said, then we administered synthetic oxytocin to different individuals in the same kind of setting, and we could turn on these positive social behaviors, moral behaviors, like opening up a garden hose. They just flow
really?
Out. Yeah, so
wow.
It looks like this is the brain's mechanism for appropriate social behaviors, connection, care, empathy.
It's causing a lot of questions in my head right now, so I'm going to try to see if I can organize these. I'm going to take it to the criminal world for a second.
Right.
So it seems like it could actually benefit in that world for some of these people who may have more of a proclivity towards bad behavior, immoral behavior. Would you think if we administer the oxytocin, would it increase their ability to be more moral or
great
more
question.
Sociable?
So as the viewers will already know, I am a brilliant scientist, and I think of every possible experiment in advance. No, it's not true at all. We run experiments, and you go, holy crap. Here's the experiment I should be running. So we had an experiment we ran in which we had a guy we had trouble getting blood from, right? Just because it was a short, chubby, frat boy guy, undergraduate. We're poking him, you know, the phlebotomist poking him. And afterwards I said, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, I apologize. You really suffered for science. Thank you so much. And he said, I love this experiment. Can I come back tomorrow? Okay, people get poked four times, don't love this experiment. And we very rarely poke people four times. Anyway.
That's interesting.
I didn't know his name, but I have his tube of blood with his ID number on it. So I just checked the behavioral data. He was one of these share the money people. The person he was matched to gave all their money to him. And when you give money to somebody in our experiments, it actually triples in size. So this person gave up the $10 they were earning for being the experiment, gave it all to him. It tripled to 30 bucks. He also got 10 bucks for showing up. He had $40 in his account. How much did he give it back to the person who trusted him? Zero.
Zero back.
Zero back. So there's a technical word for these individuals. They are unconditional non-reciprocators. So we found that a subset of people, about 2 or 3%, never return money.
What was the percentage again?
2 or 3% never return money.
2 or 3%.
So what do we really call these people? We call them bastards, right? These are not people that you want to stay down and have a
coffee with. Non-diplomatic name,
right.
Yes.
So then it occurred to me, oh, we're studying the good behaviors. Well, what about the bad behaviors? So we found in these individuals an underlying dysfunction in oxytocin. So a dysfunction that identifies a potential dysregulation in the receptor. So they all make oxytocin. Everyone we've tested now, thousands and thousands of people around the globe, and you know this, even from the jungles of Papua New Guinea, I mean, the back to the Stone Age, people make this chemical in their brains. The question was, is it signaling in the right way? So what the brain wants is contrast. When you're nice to me, boom, my brain contrasts oxytocin, releases it, and that motivates me to change my behavior. Mm-hmm. What these individuals have is a lack of contrast. They have this kind of high but constant level of oxytocin. So it means that replacing oxytocin in people with, say, criminal behavior isn't going to work because the receptors are damaged. So now you ask, how are those receptors damaged?
I was getting ready to.
So let's do that. One is genetics. So we see an enormous amount of variability in oxytocin release across individuals. We've shown that there are some genetic components of that. So there are about 200 different genetic variants for the oxytocin receptor. So
200?
We don't know if any of those are functionally different, but there's potentially lots of variability there. The second is your developmental history. So the brain itself is an economic organism. It has scarce resources that it wants to deploy efficiently to help you survive and reproduce. And in individuals who have severely adverse childhoods, this nurturing circuit, the home circuit, doesn't get activated very much. And in animals, for sure, and studies we've done in sexually abused women, shows that the number of oxytocin receptors in the front of the brain and the temporal lobe are reduced. So these people are just very emotionally flat. They don't engage. And they don't respond to these kind of kindness stimuli, if you will.
Let me get clarity for a second. You said the front of the brain, I guess the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah.
Is that where the oxytocin is being created?
It's actually made in the brainstem. This is an evolutionarily old molecule. So made in the brainstem. The receptors in the prefrontal cortex are interesting because they modulate midbrain dopamine release. And so the listeners may know dopamine is this reward reinforcement learning circuit. And so when I hold the door for you at the airport when you have your luggage and you smile and thank me, my brain only releases oxytocin. It releases a little dopamine and says, oh, apparently the humans like this behavior. I should continue doing this. So that's the sense in which, as we kind of opened your interview, there's a sense in which moral behaviors are innate, right? For most of us, we have learned by having our feet on the ground for, you know, more than 20 years that the way to sustain social relationships, sustain our place in the community, is to behave in moral ways, right? Socially appropriate ways. Let me get to the third thing that interrupts the release of oxytocin, and that's something we all have experienced, which is high levels of stress. So even you, who are a dear, dear person, I'm sure, have a bad day occasionally. Then you have to apologize to your assistant, your spouse, hey, I had a terrible day yesterday. I got a car accident. My dog died. Whatever it was. I was not a very nice person. I apologize. Now, we all understand that. So, Anyway, so three reasons. So two of those three are essentially not fixable, at least with the technologies we have today, and we could talk about future technologies. And one of those we understand well.
Can you repeat the three one more time?
So one is genetic. One is your childhood history. And the third is high levels of stress.
Now, if I correct, just to make sure I get it correct, I'm sure the audience got it correct, but it doesn't happen with me all the time. Overproduction of oxytocin was one of the issues as well, because they had too much, they weren't responding.
That's right. Overproduction is a signal that the receptors may be dysfunctional.
So we'll stick with the criminal mind for a second. Mm-hmm. Do they have a regular influencer to produce oxytocin? So what I'm saying is, for us, and I give you a hug, I shake mm-hmm. your hand, you do something for me, whatever it is, that increases my oxytocin production. But do these individuals have something else? So if they do a bad behavior, does it increase their oxytocin?
Good question. So in all the experiments we've run, we haven't found that anything but a positive social interaction, at least as perceived by the brain, induces a release of oxytocin, gives you that sense of empathy, the reduction in stress, and but it doesn't take much. So we before we went on air, we talked about social media. So we've run some experiments looking at people using social media. So here's the experiment, real simple. You come in, you get a blood draw, go in a room with a computer, use any kind of social media in private that you want. 10 minutes later, come back out, we take your blood. And sometimes we have you do these share the money tasks to see if you're nicer with the humans. And indeed, social media induces the release of oxytocin. So it looks like any connection from the brain's perspective is a good connection. We've used movies that have high social content, really reliable oxytocin releasers. So why do we cry at movies? I mean, not you and me, super macho guys, but, you know, I've heard occasionally that people cry in movies, me, because we become engaged in that social interaction, that conflict, the death of a child, the loss of a loved one, whatever that is. Like, oh my gosh. So again, it's very interesting kind of neural ballet. I know I'm in the theater. I realize where I am, and yet I can't help but be moved by this human story. So it tells us that at our core, we are deeply social and emotional creatures. And oxytocin, you know, until the work we did starting about 12, 13 years ago, was just this big, fat, missing piece of the puzzle that no one had really thought to look at. And turns out to be pretty important.
That's fantastic. I mean, I'm so glad you did the research. I'm going to harp a little bit more on the criminal mind, and then we'll get off because I have another question, a series of questions. That's why I keep writing. On the criminal mind, you said it was only a positive interaction. Is it possible, then, that this person, I'll use Ted Bundy or Charles Manson, something like that, they could have rationalized an interaction to be positive, which then produces oxytocin?
That's a good question. I don't think we know. So what we do know is that individuals, criminal individuals who lack empathy, in general, don't make oxytocin. So let me tell you how we know that. So if I'm going to study 2% of the free-roaming humans, which is about the proportion of psychopaths in the population, it'll take me a long time to find enough of those people to study. So it took us a couple years of permission to go to a treatment facility for criminal psychopaths in Wisconsin. So we spent 2 weeks there with our team, and we took blood from 161 of these men who are already diagnosed as psychopaths, which runs on a continuum, and we also know their criminal history. By the way, after we did the study on them, we found their criminal history. I didn't want to be in the room and be biased in any way. So we had them watch a very short video of a father and a son, and the son's dying of cancer. It's very sad. Most people feel great empathy for this. Some people cry. And we just said, how do you feel? And that's a reliable oxytocin releaser. And what happened to these guys? On average, zero oxytocin release.
Zero?
Zero. And what is the hallmark of psychopathology? A lack of empathy. So we've confirmed that in this clinical population.
Actually, saddens me. I'd hate to see that for anybody, any kind of human at all, to have that inability to produce it and to be deprived of such wonderful emotions.
Hi, welcome to Adelante. This is Adelante Recovery, and my name is Yvette Kuglin. And I'm part of the staff.
Adelante Recovery Center has helped people in dual diagnosis for 5 years. We accept most PPO insurances and provide luxury accommodations and 24-hour support. To speak with an admissions counselor, call 1-888-242-4450.
lot of time we don't even know what's wrong with us, and sometimes we need to get away, figure that out. So if you want to go for a little retreat out in Corona Del Mar, which is a confidential location, we're here to help. So we're only a phone call away. Thank you.
Once again, Dr. Paul Zak, The Moral Molecule, a book you have to get. We're going to continue the conversation now. So we know it produces it. We've seen lack of it. Is there anything that actually reduces the production?
There is. So we certainly talked about stress doing it. Mm-hmm. We have found interesting gender differences in how oxytocin is taken up by the brain. There are several ways to come at this. One is a sort of natural way. So because we're taking blood from people, we can assess a variety of other neurochemicals that can interact with oxytocin. So we found naturally, for example, that has been confirmed in animals, that when women have high levels of estrogen, estrogen increases the uptake of oxytocin by its receptor. Mm-hmm. So over the menstrual cycle, women have two peaks in estrogen, and so they may become a little more socially sensitive, a little more emotional, a little more empathic during those peaks. And progesterone, which is the hormone of ovulation and of pregnancy, inhibits the uptake of oxytocin. So women, in every study we've run in 12 years, release more oxytocin on average than men, but sometimes they don't, depending on where they are in their menstrual cycle. So women, we love you. You're nicer than we are. We know that, but you're also more complicated. We found that another potent inhibitor for oxytocin is testosterone. So again, established in animals and studies we've done in humans where we administer testosterone to men and compare their behavior to themselves on placebo, we see that high testosterone males are more selfish and more entitled. That is, they demand more from others and offer less to others. So, Carlos, who are the least empathic, kind people on the planet?
Psychopaths again.
And teenage boys, which two of them used to be, right? So, I wouldn't expect young males to be crying at the Bambi movie like I do because I'm old and have kids and I'm a nice person, right? So when we were 15, we were probably not the most empathic people. And that sort of testosterone poisoning, if you will, you grow out of it. So, you know, nature has given this amazing system to us in which when you're in a committed relationship, a man's testosterone falls. As you age, it falls. When you have children, your testosterone falls. So that balance between oxytocin and testosterone, the sort of drive, dominance, aggression of testosterone, is balanced by the sort of nurturing of oxytocin. It's kind of a beautiful thing.
Interesting. That's so fascinating. So many questions. A couple here that I just wrote down as we were talking. Holidays. We were talking about movies. We were talking about females. We were talking about males. Does a holiday season increase oxytocin levels by any chance? Because that's good spirits always out there.
Good question. I mean, I think if it's a social interaction opportunity, it is. So if we're going to holiday parties, going to holiday rituals, church, you know, all those things when we come together are great oxytocin releasers. So as you may remember, the book opens with me at a wedding in England. In which I'm showing up, and I don't know a single person, and I have, you know, my lab coat and centrifuge and needles and test tubes, and I took blood from the bride and the groom and the wedding party and the family and the friends to find out, why are you spending $50,000, $100,000 on a wedding? That sounds pretty insane. So we found that not only did this ritual induce the release of oxytocin, it did it in a very particular way. That is, oxytocin is not a 0-1 relationship. It's a graded relationship. So when we met earlier and I gave you a hug, released a little oxytocin. You're a nice person. You seem like a fine person. My brain says, this is the guy you can interact with. When my little kids, my little darling daughters come up and hug me, a lot more oxytocin release. I'm connecting more to them. So in the wedding, you know, who's the center of the wedding solar system? The bride. She released the most. Who loves the wedding almost as much as the bride? The bride's mother. She's number two. Then the family and the friends. So they're kind of arrayed around the bride like planets around the sun.
You took everybody's blood in that?
We took, I think, 15 or 16 people's blood. Wow. So, but the strength of the relationship between the bride and the individuals was indexed by the amount of oxytocin they released. And so that tells us something important. So let me be concrete. In one of the social media experiments we did, a Korean TV station came out to film it, and because I guess they love social media, and we put their producers and reporters in the study. It makes it more fun. And when I got the blood results back, I wrote a report for them, and one of these guys, one of the producers, was, I don't know, 22, 23 years old. He was using social media in private, got his blood drawn, and his oxytocin went up 150%.
Whoa.
So the average of these experiments is like 15 to 20%, which is a nice solid increase in oxytocin. And that has a big behavioral effect. 150% is off the map. So when I wrote the report, I said, look, I don't know what this guy was doing, but my guess was he was interacting with either his girlfriend or his mother, someone extraordinarily important to him. They checked. He was posting to his girlfriend's Facebook page. Right? So oxytocin gives us this insight into the strength of connections.
Yeah.
So I think then the sort of unanswered question is, you sort of asked it earlier, what can I do about it? Right? So there's good evidence in animals and a little emerging evidence in humans that we can bias ourselves to connect better to people by essentially exercising this muscle in the brain. So the more I connect to people, the more I bias my brain to releasing oxytocin, or at higher quantities releasing oxytocin, and I'm connecting to those around me better. So we found in experiments that individuals who release the most oxytocin after a stimulus are in fact more satisfied with their lives, and they're more satisfied because they have better relationships of all types. So they're closer to their romantic partners, they're closer to their family members, they have more friends, and even in our experiments, they're kinder to strangers. And so if that's the world we want to live in, I think it really starts with one connection at a time, right? If you give someone else the gift of oxytocin release, you give them a hug, you do a kindness to them, then the oxytocin is going to stay higher in the brain for about half an hour, which means they're more prone to being nicer to the next person they meet. And then we have this nice virtuous cycle in which we're creating a better society by increasing the quality of those interactions one person at a time.
It's a great, great strategy to improve the way the world is working. Before we continue on, substance abuse. You know, we're talking about things that hinder the production of oxytocin. Does substance abuse, drugs, alcohol, any of that affect the production of oxytocin?
Great neuroscience question. So it turns out that stimulants, methamphetamine, cocaine, in animals damage these receptors for oxytocin in the prefrontal cortex. So I know you've seen people who are long-term drug users, and they tend to, again, be emotionally flat. They don't tend to draw on their social support, for example, to stay sober. So part of that may be due to damage in the brain in lots of areas, but in particular in these receptors for oxytocin that, for us healthy people, make it feel good to be connected to those around us. So for these individuals, they don't really get that. For alcohol, that's a great question. We just finished running a study comparing alcohol to oxytocin release. We'll let you know in a couple of months.
Excellent.
So again, alcohol has good and bads. I mean, in moderate quantities, may kind of loosen us up and allow us to connect better. Obviously, in high quantities, it's detrimental.
So we just don't know.
So again, these pathways in the brain are a lot of parallelism, and so there's never a one-to-one relationship in the brain. I think we should say that for viewers too. It's not a one-to-one mapping between me releasing oxytocin and me being, I don't know, kind to you. Right? There's lots of other compensatory and inhibitory factors, and that's really where the research got interesting. And that's why you got to write a whole book about this. So, but knowing about that, I think, gives us an insight into, you know, the kind of unusual behaviors we see in others. So, what I think I've learned from this is, instead of saying, "Gosh, you know, dear Carlos was not very nice to me today, and maybe he doesn't like me anymore," I can say, "Oh, maybe you're having a bad day. Maybe you're stressed. Maybe you need more support from me, not less support." So, here's something that comes out of the neuroscience, just as an example. I have little kids. I do what, you know, most parents do. We use the timeout as the punishment. Ah, yes. Right? So timeout says, look, you're unhappy, you're misbehaving, we're going to put you away from the rest of the social group to stress you, to try to reinforce that this is not appropriate behavior. I started thinking about this from a neuroscience perspective. This is actually not the right thing to do. It says, you're stressing out, so I'm going to give you more stress. Right? So I invented the time in, which is, you're having a bad day right now, you need to sit in my lap for as many minutes as you are old, and I'm going to hold you. And that's going to release oxytocin. That's going to calm you down. What you need is more support. You don't need less support and more stress in your life. So the nice thing about this is my little daughter loves it, and my teenage daughter is scared to death I'll do it when her friends are over. So you know, it works both ways.
That's a wonderful idea. I have two daughters as well. I have to try that next time. So the time out, the time in, I love that. Let's see how we can use, you alluded a couple of times to how you can maybe improve the society or the world by using oxytocin, or at least helping it produce more, helping humans produce it more. I'm getting a picture in my head about lone terrorists. I see these poor individuals. They may not be psychopaths. We don't know necessarily what they all are. I haven't got the data on that. But some of these individuals don't have a social network. They're alone a lot. Mm-hmm. Then they start creating these stories, whether it's real for them or fabricated, I don't know. But I wonder, what do you think, if we were to give them oxytocin, if we were able to first identify one, right? Mm-hmm. But if we identify one of these people who's alone, who's isolated from the community, isolated from the world, and we give them oxytocin, is it possible we could bring them back into the fold, per se?
We have received a lot of money, a lot of your tax revenue from the Department of Defense in the last 3 or 4 years to do work on terrorism and non-state actors. It's slightly more complicated than that. So individuals who are isolated will seek out a social group. They'll seek out a gang. They'll seek out a terrorist organization. The way they do that is by essentially buying into a narrative about what this group is doing and why it's valuable and important. Right? Even gangs think of themselves as extraordinary in some way. What we've done with DoD funding is look at changing the story, changing the narrative, understanding, again, generically why we cry at movies, but also how to tell a persuasive narrative. How do I counter-message that narrative? So if I have generally young males, although not exclusively, who are isolated, who are frustrated, who can't get jobs, can't get married, that we can channel that wonderful energy that young men have, driven by testosterone, into more productive means. So much of the work we've done in the last couple of years has focused on the neurobiology of narratives, right? So when do we get so engrossed in stories? How do we, as you said, essentially change that narrative so that it becomes more of a positive narrative as opposed to a negative narrative?
It's interesting, because I can see that little nasal spray really helping out a lot.
You know, I like to say hugs, not drugs. What we've really worked on is understanding how the brain naturally makes this. And if I can create an environment in which you feel recognized and nurtured and cared about, then your brain's going to activate the system, presuming that it's not so damaged that it doesn't work, and you know, bring you kind of back into this sense of community that we all need. So having said that, you know, the briefings I've been to on what happens to children in many of these societies where terrorism is bred would turn your stomach. And so the sense of having the proper nurturing. So it's really not about dragging people. It's really about understanding the kinds of environments and societies and narratives that allow people to feel connected and comfortable. By the way, a lot of the work we're doing currently, in fact, the next book I'm writing, is applying this to organizations. So it turns out that high-trust organizations are actually much more productive. Employees are much happier. They're healthier. You know, there are still, you know, every job has its drags, but when you can create a culture in which you feel recognized, you feel challenged, you feel like you understand the larger mission of why you're coming here, people love that. And you have many opportunities during the workday to release oxytocin, have a sense of teamwork and camaraderie. And these organizations, again, are not only more performing at a higher level, but actually create better citizens, better employees. People are happier, healthier, better parents.
It's an awesome
better people
thing.
In the world. So I think there are a lot of applications here, but none of those have to do with drugging people.
Actually, you touched on another question I was going to ask you. You said trust actually releases oxytocin as well.
Mm-hmm. So we took that was our initial experiments where we had people entrust others with their money. And you'd do that because the money would grow in size, but you'd have to give up control over it. And this was done by a computer. And so it is interesting that the sort of first kind of media attention we had for oxytocin in 2004, 2005, called the trust molecule. And then, you know, once we had established that oxytocin facilitates this kind of reciprocation after one's trusted, the question is how far could we push that? So would it make you, from the trust perspective, it's kind of a win-win. How about oxytocin increasing kind of a win-lose? Would it motivate me to help you even though there's no benefit to myself? That is to be, for example, generous. We found it, yes. So we continue to kind of push these boundaries on moral behaviors that we can run in the laboratory. And then we took those behaviors and look at them in the field. So we've gone from everywhere from to churches, to trainings by the Army, to folk dances, and in all these situations, when the humans get together, they release oxytocin. And when they release oxytocin, they feel more connected to their community. So it's an important part, I think, of what it means to be a social creature as a human being.
Fantastic molecule. We have a few minutes left. I wanted to talk a little bit about the question I was going to ask you is being moral unique to humans? So it started taking me into the world of evolutionary psychology. Mm-hmm. One of the thoughts I had, I don't know if you can even answer this, but maybe at least hypothesize, is do you think it was possible, because it looks like it's innate, something we desire, we like, it keeps us together. Maybe before that time, there were actually maybe some kind of form of humans or Homo sapiens, Homo erectus or something that didn't have that. And then maybe it just kind of developed into the brain.
Mm-hmm. So there is some evidence that I talk about in the book that around 200,000 years ago, there seemed to be a genetic variant in which some proto-humans, these are Homo sapiens, but they're severely Homo sapiens, started getting many more oxytocin receptors, particularly in the front of the brain. And when they did that, you see this consequent increase in social behavior. So humans around 200,000 years ago, 150,000 years ago, started moving from living in basically family-based tribal groups to this sort of larger communities. Mm-hmm. That wasn't until about 10,000 years ago we had civilizations. But, you know, the essence of civilization is living and working around people that you are not genetically related to. And that can only happen if I have something in my head that says this person trustworthy, that person not, right? So it's a kind of a necessary precondition. Now, the dating on when that happened is always dicey. It depends on the rate at which genes mutate, and we can debate about that. But yeah, it does seem like, you know, this moral motivation has been in human beings for quite a long time. In fact, all mammals have oxytocin. They all make it. Facilitates live birth and care for offspring, which is the hallmark of mammals. But humans have this much larger density of oxytocin receptors than any other animal, although other social creatures have it. So we actually have a research study coming out in a couple of months where we looked at capuchin monkeys. So capuchin monkeys are little teeny monkeys that live in trees, a little puff of white hair on the head, and they're highly social. They live in female-based groups. Many other monkey species are not very social, and if they are, generally led by males who are very aggressive. And so we thought, look, if there's any evidence for this in the monkey kingdom, it'll be in primates who are social. And what's the result? It's complicated.
Ah.
Okay, so in the study, we had these little monkeys pull very heavy bars with a tray on them to get food. And sometimes the food went to both of us, sometimes only went to one. The question is, would they share food? So that's our behavioral measure of moral behavior, if you will. And the short answer is that oxytocin does not, given to one monkey or both, doesn't directly affect food sharing. What it does do is it reduces the stress of being isolated from my troop. So these capuchin monkeys live as a group. And when we put them in cages to test them, they don't like that. This is like solitary confinement for prisoners. Right now I'm isolated from my social group. I can see them, but I can't interact with them. So what the oxytocin did was it moved the monkeys closer to the partition. Moved them farther from the partition. So when they're stressed, they sit as close to the other monkey as they can. We give them oxytocin, it's like physiologically we've just reduced that desire for social interaction. Like, I don't need to affiliate so much, so now I'm just backing up. And so when I back up and I eat my food and I drop it, more food sharing occurs. So again, the brain's complicated. So we have to understand that there are multiple mechanisms in the brain that affect our social behaviors and also how we feel, how our emotional states. And oxytocin is one of those, but it's one that seems to have this big effect on appropriate social behaviors.
Wow. A quick question here on free will. I'm interested in free will. The oxytocin seems to be a reactive mm-hmm. hormone. So does it ever engage first? In other words, I'm trying to see how I can put this. Sometimes we have a dopamine release about something that can maybe motivate us to do a certain activity.
Right.
Maybe actually take away our free will because the dopamine rushes too much. And instead of us being consciously making the decision, the dopamine kind of making the decision. Is that possible in regards to oxytocin, or is it just really a reactionary kind of hormone?
We do find that. So again, there's a suite of neurochemicals that are trying to guide us through the social environment in which we live. So oxytocin is a rapid response molecule in the brain, released within about a second of a social stimulus, and does, as we've shown over and over, you know, affect behavior. So free will is a giant, you know, matzo ball in the soup. And so I don't want to take that one on, but oxytocin certainly motivates these appropriate social behaviors and facilitates both release of dopamine and serotonin. And so there's a suite of neurochemicals that our brain is soaked in that are helping us survive. And I think what's interesting, and I, you know, maybe the take home of the book is, you know, moral behaviors are valuable because they help us survive and reproduce. So even for people who don't believe in God or an afterlife or anything else, moral behaviors are vitally important because they're what keep us embedded in our social communities. And almost no humans can survive alone. I mean, there must be the rare hermit out there somewhere, but that's not generally the most adaptive behavior.
Actually, that's the question, or the last question, or before your fastball question, which is coming soon. Religion, how does that impact?
Right. So if I can give a 30-second backstory. When we first started doing this work, because we want to look at behavior and not beliefs or self-report, we did ask people, do you believe in God? Do you pray? Do you go to church? And none of that really affected oxytocin release or any of these moral behaviors that we looked at. And so we just kind of dropped it and we stopped there. And as writing the book, you know, there's a chapter on religion, and I said, you know, I don't think I've explored this issue further enough, and you know, enough. And the reason was I have a funny background, which is my mother, before she was my mother, was a Catholic nun, and religion was sort of shoved down my throat. You don't have a choice when you have, you know, the Pope's former emissary in your household. So I kind of rejected that, you know, there's only one true religion, this is the only way to go to heaven. And even though I'd say I'm a very spiritual person, I just didn't think, it just doesn't make sense to me logically that, you know, there's only one real church. If God's universal, then God's universal, right? Anyway, so I just avoided those questions. And I said, I'm kind of being a weenie here. So we now have run studies where we've have brought religious people into the lab, have them worship, have them pray, have them sing, measure their oxytocin release, measure their social behaviors. We've gone to churches and, with permission, of course, taken blood before and after services, even so far as going to sort of animistic religion. So I got permission to go into the jungles of Papua New Guinea and take blood from indigenous people living in the rainforest. I mean, no running water, no electricity, brought in generators, brought in liquid nitrogen.
Oh, wow.
These guys had never been to a doctor or dentist before. In all these cases, the rituals they perform induce the release of oxytocin, bring them closer in communion to their community members. But we haven't found that oxytocin enhances a sense of relationship to God or some ultimate reality or the universe. We've asked it lots of different ways. So whatever that sense of connection is doesn't seem to be driven by oxytocin. But I do think the rituals are vitally important, like the wedding I discussed, vitally important because they're opportunities for us to bond together as a community.
Fascinating. Did you by any chance do any research on prayer?
We have looked a little at prayer. Again, we've had people come in and worship in groups, and we find that, again, prayer does cause the release of oxytocin, connects us to others that we're praying with, but doesn't make us necessarily nicer people to complete strangers any more than just the oxytocin release. So there's no extra benefit of prayer other than it's just an opportunity to kind of reinforce these appropriate social behaviors.
Interesting. Well, here's a question for you, your fastball question. So when we see a movie star that we are attracted to, does that increase oxytocin?
No question about it. The best oxytocin stimulus is sex. And if you think about attraction, think about sex, your oxytocin goes up. How do we know this? Remember, I'm a brilliant scientist. We ran a study in which their computer software crumped. So I told the kids, look, we're working on this. We'll fix the software. Surf the web. Just relax. And as I'm going back and forth to check on it, I see a guy looking at some kind of rock and roll website with scantily clad women. And I just, being sort of anal retentive, noted that in my little lab notebook, and we checked this guy's oxytocin through the roof. We had to throw him out of the study. So, yeah, just fantasizing about your favorite movie star will cause your oxytocin to go up. But maybe that's not a bad thing. Maybe you're nicer to your spouse. You're nicer to your colleagues. Maybe we should fantasize more about our favorite stars.
Hollywood's loving this one. And that leads me to my last question, actually. I wanted to get to it before we wrap up, is marketing. That seems like this is going to be heading that direction for sure. You're in economics as well. Is it being used yet in marketing? Has it always been used in marketing?
You know, it's always been used poorly. I mean, why are there puppies and toilet paper commercials? we've actually shown that petting dogs releases oxytocin. So you have this, I can fantasize about the puppy that I love so much, right? So we've actually begun doing work first with the U.S. government, but now with actually corporations to help them understand why some ads really move us. And when we're moved by an ad, we should remember the brand better. You know, we're all going to be seeing ads. We're all going to be seeing movies. I think what we're doing is helping make those more compelling. You still have a nice big prefrontal cortex. If you see this ad and you cry because the Olympic skier finally, you know, reaches the finish line after so many tries, okay, you had a wonderful moving experience from this story. It doesn't mean you're going to buy the toilet paper, right? So people still have choice. What we're doing is really working on understanding why these stories with such social content move us so much. And I think that's an important part of our human nature. So it's fun to do, and it holds our feet to the fire. If we really understand this oxytocin social brain system, we should be able to tell a company, look, this is when this engages. So a lot of the work we did, by the way, was on public service announcements. So we looked at whether people who watch a public service announcement, don't drink and drive, don't use drugs, would actually donate to a charity after they saw that, even though the announcement doesn't ask for an advertisement. So we again found that oxytocin predicted engagement with the narrative, with the characters in the story, and how much you would donate to charity. So we're using this to do things like look at non-smoking public service announcements, how to keep kids from using drugs. So I think there's a lot of good uses for this. But yeah, the corporations can help fund this too. And if you get better commercials on TV, hey, who's going to complain about that?
That's right. Now, Dr. Zach has mentioned he was a brilliant scientist, and I tell you, after this interview, I have no doubt about it. Once again, the book, Dr. Paul Zach, The Moral Molecule, you have to get it. Thank you so much for being on The Circle. I got to get my hug, and I got to get my oxytocin.
Let's go.
Remember, wherever there's psychology involved, we're there. See you next time, everyone. And now we have a special feature at the end of our shows, a singer or talent of the month. This month in March, we have Rebecca Jade, and the first song on this show will be Stranded. I hope you enjoy it.
Choose your fate, life goes and grabs you.